Now let's get back to the bishop's book, back to the four chapters of the new Reformation. As I said at the beginning, the first chapter is called Troubling the Waters. This chapter is in fact mainly concerned very much with what we have been talking about so far. The bishop is concerned to assure us, to convince us if necessary, that the new Reformation is already here, that it's already begun. There's no question apparently in his mind of let's have a new Reformation, whether we like it or not, or in this case whether Christians like it or not, the new Reformation is already here in the midst of us. And as I've pointed out already, it's here in the midst, not only of Christians, but also of Buddhists. We know very well that many Christians, even we may say most Christians, don't realize that their own new Reformation has begun. Many no doubt tend to write off the Bishop of Woolwich and people like him. He's just an eccentric. He's the sort of person that the Church of England can afford to accommodate. It doesn't matter. It's a sort of safety valve for the younger folk. One needn't take it too seriously. This is the attitude of many. They don't want to face up to the fact that they've got the new Reformation within Christianity, whether they like it or not. They continue, almost grimly, hanging on to the old ways. If they talk at all of Reformation, they talk of it in a sense peculiarly their own. They tend to think perhaps of Reformation as meaning getting everybody back into church. There's been a decline of religion, people become very materialistic, they drifted away from the churches, or have a Reformation, get them all back into their pews, comfortable or otherwise. But don't change the church. The church is there, the buildings are already furnished, hundreds and hundreds of empty seats, so they're already waiting. Reformation means shepherding people, with a little gentle pressure perhaps, into those empty seats. So that's Reformation. Now, I'm sorry to say that we sometimes find the same sort of thing in Buddhism. From having smiled at Christianity, you can all smile at Buddhism. We smile at ourselves. Not exactly, or not quite literally, because we find this sort of thing not so much in the West, of course, but in the Buddhist East. I've travelled a little in the Buddhist East, and I found very often monks and elderly lay people complaining that the young people, especially the Western educated young people, have very little time for Buddhism. It's not that they're against it, they just don't bother. It just seems to them a trifle irrelevant. This is a situation one finds in many parts of the Buddhist East. There's the complaint there that Buddhist young people don't go to the temple. They don't go and make offerings to the monks. I remember some young men in a Buddhist country told me, we don't go to the temple. Why? We don't go and see the monks. Why? Because the custom is that you must sit on your knees. So that's all right when you're wearing a lungi or a sarung, but when you're wearing a nicely creased pair of Western trousers, you don't want to sit on your knees on the floor, because it'll spoil your crease, they say. So they don't go. So this is a trivial sort of example, but it does illustrate the sort of thing which happens. So the Western educated young people, especially those who have some scientific knowledge, in the Buddhist countries, they very often tend to drift away from Buddhism and to care very little for it. And one must say, in all fairness to them, that in some parts of the Buddhist world in the East, very little attempt is made on the part of those who ought to be making the attempt to make Buddhism intelligible to these people who have received a Western education. It's the same very often when it comes to preaching Buddhism in the West. There are lots of very nice, innocent Eastern Buddhists in Ceylon and Burma and Thailand, and even Tibet and Japan and China, who think it will be a wonderful idea, a glorious idea, to come and preach Buddhism in the West. Well, it's a very laudable sort of ambition, but the vast majority have got no idea of what they're up against. They just don't know how difficult it is to preach religion of any sort here in the West. It's difficult even for Dr. Billy Graham, I believe. So how much more difficult for a Buddhist monk or Buddhist layman coming from the East. Even those who do think in terms of preaching Buddhism in the West tends to think in terms of repeating the old familiar formulae and the old familiar pattern over here in the West. This is natural, of course, when they haven't had any previous experience of conditions here, but it is perhaps an outlook which isn't going to get Buddhism in the West very far. It is perhaps one of the reasons why in the West generally, not only here in England, but in Europe and America too, there are so many different types of national Buddhism. See, when Christian missionaries go to the East, they're usually distinguished, not on basis of nationality, but sect. The Catholics, the Protestants, the Methodists, the Baptists, the Seventh-day Adventists, and so on. But in the West, Buddhists coming to preach Buddhism from the East are usually distinguished not on a doctrinal or theological basis, but on a national basis. We speak about the Sinhalese Buddhists, or the Tibetan Buddhists, or the Thai Buddhists. And this is rather significant, because it's because each tends to reproduce, or to try to reproduce, in this country, its own national religious and cultural patterns, rather than to produce something which is suitable for the indigenous patterns of this country. There was a rather beautiful example not so very long ago, in fact just over a week ago, which was taken note of, apparently, by the Observer newspaper. And they were writing, as some of you must have seen, about the Buddhist movement in this country, and about the full moon day, and about this vihara. So they just happened to point out, they commented on the fact that the full moon day was celebrated by different Buddhist groups on different days. And they mentioned that the Sinhalese Buddhists in London celebrated the full moon day on the Thursday. Even though according to the calendar, it's on a Friday. But they celebrate on a Thursday, because according to the Sinhalese calendar, which they brought all the way from Ceylon, full moon day was on Thursday. So instead of looking up into the sky in England and seeing whether it was full moon or not, they looked into their calendar. So since the Sinhalese calendar said full moon day Thursday, they observed it on Thursday, regardless of whether it was full moon day in England on Thursday or Friday. Then the report went on to point out that the Thai Buddhists had observed it not on Thursday, but on Friday, because presumably their calendar agreed with the English one. Sometimes in India, by the way, you can get quite startling variations. I've been sometimes in places where different Buddhist groups, national groups, had five different full moon days, as it were, all in a row, which of course makes for variety, but hardly for unity. But what is significant is that the Observer, as some of you must have noticed, went on to point out that the English Buddhists, referring to ourselves of course, weren't going to have their full moon day celebration on the full moon day at all. They were going to have their full moon day celebration on the Sunday, immediately after their lecture, and that theirs was the pragmatic approach. A pragmatic apparently being a term of praise for that particular reporter rather than anything else. So this is just a simple example, you see, of how difficult it is for Eastern Buddhists that are coming to the West to drop their own national, religious and cultural patterns. It's very difficult because they're not familiar with anything else. Now, when one speaks of the necessity of an adaptation to local conditions, one doesn't, of course, mean a compromise. But what is needed, and what very often we don't get, is an attempt to speak about Buddhism in terms with which people are familiar. For the Eastern Buddhist, this seems to be very, very difficult for some reason or other. It may be partly because in many parts of the Buddhist world, Buddhism is having to adopt an increasingly defensive sort of posture, so they tend to withdraw within themselves. But if Buddhism is to spread in this country, then whoever spreads it, whether from the East or whether from the West, will have to learn to speak the language, not only the English language, but the cultural, religious, the secular language of this country and of this age. So these are the sort of points which the Bishop of Woolwich has drawn attention to in a Christian context, which I'm now trying to transpose, as it were, into the Buddhistic context.